Welcome. Welcome to Perimeter Institute. Welcome to Perimeter's public lecture series, and welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach, and it is a pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening, those of you here in the theater and those of you watching online. Now, I'd also like to recognize BMO for Women, who is a supporting partner of tonight's lecture. And now the lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour and will be followed by question and answer. For those of you watching online, Dr. Damian Pope and a team of PI researchers are behind their keyboards, ready to engage in conversation. If you want to engage in that conversation and ask some questions, use hashtag PILive. And we'll also take questions from that same feed at the end of the talk for me to ask to our presenters. All right, and now tonight, we have a special format for you as we host two phenomenal researchers who are working together to look beyond traditional academic boundaries and to target specific problems in neuroscience. Dr. Anne Andrews is a neuroscientist and a professor at the University of California, where she leads transformational research on anxiety and depression. Her interdisciplinary research team focuses on understanding serotonin regulation of complex behaviors, including anxiety, mood, stress responsiveness, learning, and memory. Dr. Paul Weiss is a nanoscientist and holds the University of California Presidential Chair. He studies the ultimate limits of miniaturization, developing new tools and methods for atomic resolution, spectroscopic imaging, and chemical patterning. He applies these advances in areas including neuroscience and microbiome studies. Together, their scientific collaboration has allowed them to guide advances in nanotechnology to take on grand challenges in biology and in medicine. Tonight, each of them will discuss their research and how looking outside of their own scientific areas has led to ongoing advances in biology and medicine. So please welcome to the stage Dr. Anne Andrews and Dr. Paul Weiss.
Let's start here. Wow. This is really exciting for me to be here tonight. Here at the Perimeter Institute, I don't think I have to convince any of you, particularly those who come to these lectures regularly, that space is what we consider a final frontier. Space defines and defies our notions of perimeters and breakthroughs in theoretical and experimental physics and astronomy have enabled us to collect images like the one you see here that was collected by the Hubble Space Telescope. And it's an image of our most nearest neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. However, I would like to convince you that we have another final frontier. And that final frontier is the final frontier that's within us, in our brains. The human brain and the complexity of the human brain arguably rivals that of our universe. The secrets to our thoughts and the inner workings of our brain, however, require us to bring together scientists from many different disciplines. So in fact, today I'm going to talk to you about work that we're doing that unites physicians and biologists, physicists and chemists, and a nanoscientist and a neuroscientist. Importantly, we also hope that through these types of collaborative efforts, what we're doing is we're training the next generations of scientists. These will be scientists that will be naturally inclined to look across disciplinary boundaries so that we'll be able to solve hard problems in science. So when I was a girl, something like this was a thing of science fiction. How many here remember Beam Me Up, Scotty? Right. I always think of that when I'm holding my phone up to my face. Today, computers are everywhere, and they're getting smaller and faster and more powerful every day. And so it's not really hard to imagine why people might think that our brain may be like a computer and work like a computer. In fact, some of the most powerful computers are doing pretty amazing things today. In 2011, IBM's Watson computer defeated the best human players at Jeopardy, a game that Paul's father and Paul love. And today, Watson is helping doctors to make important decisions in healthcare. Given this ubiquity and power, some people think the brain works like a computer. But what I hope I'm going to convince you of today is that that's not at all correct. In fact, this beautiful thing right here has very little, if anything, in common with this. And what's exciting is how we can bring scientists and trainees together to try to solve these important problems. Now, computers run on bits and bytes. They run on ones and zeros, yeses and nos. But in fact, neuroscientists have been arguing for many, many decades about what the fundamental nature is of how neurons communicate with one another. And the early discovery of neurons was based on two very important tools. The first was the light microscope. And the second was something called the Golgi stain. And the Golgi stain is named after an Italian scientist named Emilio Golgi. And what it enabled these early neuroanatomists to do was to stain only a very small percentage of neurons in a tissue section, way less than 1%. And the neurons that would take up this silver stain, they would take it up in their entirety. And so this enabled these early anatomists, using the light microscope, to image individual neurons and to see them in their entire complexity. And we can see that here in these beautiful images that were taken by Santiago Ramon Cajal, who was a Spanish scientist. And these are neurons from the cerebellum, two different types. And he categorized many different types of neurons in the brain using this kind of staining. Now, one of the things that couldn't be done at this time, however, because the resolving power of the light microscope was not good enough, was that they could not image the exact connections between neurons. And so these early neuroscientists argued about the nature, the fundamental nature of how neurons communicate with one another. One group, and in fact the larger camp in this early argument, was a camp that was called the Sparks. And the reason they were named the Sparks was because we already knew at that time that the way a signal is sent along a neuron is an electrochemical signal. And so the Sparks hypothesized that neurons directly touched one another. And then when one neuron would want to send a signal to a second neuron, that electrical spark would jump directly from a single neuron to another neuron. However, there was a second, smaller camp in this argument. And that second camp was named the Soups. Okay? I kind of like that, the Sparks and the Soups. This group hypothesized that, in fact, neurons don't physically touch one another. And they had some indirect evidence that maybe, in fact, there was some kind of a signaling molecule that was passed between neurons that enabled them to communicate. And it really wasn't until 50 years later, when the electron microscope was discovered, and we began to be able to image neurons at much higher resolution, that it was in fact confirmed structurally that there is about a 10 to 20 nanometer gap between individual neurons. This gap is called a synapse. And in fact, we now know that when one neuron wants to send information to another neuron, it takes that electrochemical signal and it transduces it into a purely chemical signal, releasing this chemical signaling molecule into the extracellular space. Now, the experiment that in fact decided who won the war of the soups and the sparks was an experiment that was done in 1921 by a German scientist named Otto von Luis. And von Luis was studying dissected frog hearts. And when you remove a heart, it has an intrinsic pacemaker activity. And so the cells of the heart will continue to beat at a characteristic frequency. Von Luis was taking these frog hearts, and they still had their connected vagus nerve. The vagus nerve connects the heart to the brain. And he placed them in a physiological bath, and then he stimulated the vagus nerve. And he observed that upon stimulation, the intrinsic beating frequency would slow down. And what he did that was very clever was then he then took the bath from a first heart and he put it on a second heart. And he observed that the beating of the second heart then also slowed down, even without stimulation of the vagus nerve. And these findings then convinced the whole field, the early field of neuroscience, that in fact, even before they could visualize the synapse, that in fact these chemical messengers must exist. So, von Luis's experiments enabled us to discover the first chemical neurotransmitter, and that's a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And here's a signal from it here. Today, however, we know that there may be as many as 100 different substances that are used by neurons to communicate with one another. And you can see in this beautiful work done by my colleague Bob Kennedy at the University of Michigan that in a single sample from the extracellular space, he can separate, detect, and identify up to 70 different neuroactive substances. The other thing we've learned actually many things about the brain that defy some of our early hypotheses. But two of the findings I think that are most interesting, beyond the fact that there are many different neurotransmitter signaling molecules, is the fact that the way the brain, the way neurons in the brain are connected, they're not wired up one-to-one as they were in the cartoon that I showed you in the drawing. In fact, now with high-resolution fluorescence microscopy, like the image that you see here, we know that each neuron in the brain is talking to or is signaling as many as 1,000 to 10,000 other neurons at the same time. And each neuron in your brain is receiving information from 1,000 or 10,000 neurons at the same time. Okay, this is really tremendous. We can see this in the anatomy of these neurons. These are the synaptic boutons. Each one of these represents a connection with another neuron. Okay? We also know, in fact, that for each neurotransmitter, neurons can express many different receptors. And the receptors are the ears. They listen to the neurotransmitter signals. And so you can imagine a single neuron, it may be listening to many different neurotransmitters at the same time, and it may be able to transduce those signals in many different ways by virtue of these different receptors that it's expressing. And so when we start to think about this level of complexity now, okay, in the terms of the number of different substances that are used by neurons for chemical communication, and the complexity of the neuroanatomy, and the complexity of the molecular receptors, we begin to see that brains are in fact not digital, They're not zeros and ones in terms of the way they send information. And in fact, brains are very much unlike a computer and much more like a symphony. They're a rich, many-layered analog communication system. So if you think about a drummer, a single drummer with a single drumstick beating on a single snare drum, that would be tap, 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 right? That's not what music is all about, right? Music is about the complexity that arises from many different instruments playing many different parts all at the same time. And that's the symphony, the chemical symphony that's going on in your heads right now. 6 years ago, or what seems like an eternity to many Americans, and I'm sure to many Canadians, Paul and I had the distinct pleasure, as we have tonight, in having pleasure, of being at the White House for President Obama's announcement of the BRAIN, the U.S. BRAIN Initiative. In this case, BRAIN stands for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. Now, it's funny the way things go around in a circle in life. I told you about the war of the soups and the sparks. Paul and I were part of advocating this initiative to the White House early in its development. And one of the reasons that Paul was involved was because it was envisioned that because many of these structures and milieus, if you will, in the brain are nanoscale, that nanoscientists would play an important role in developing some of these new technologies. And myself, I was there almost as a lone voice, back again, warring against the sparks. Because the large group of people that were supporting this initiative were really pushing for new technologies that would enable us to measure ever greater spiking frequencies of neurons at ever greater densities. And they proposed that in doing so, we would figure out how brains work. And that's our fundamental goal. But for me, I kept thinking back to everything I've told you so far this evening and my own focus on the neurotransmitter serotonin. And I thought, how are we ever going to figure out how the brain works if we neglect this chemical symphony? It seems impossible that we'll be able to understand how information is encoded in neuronal signaling. And so we were able to convince the powers that be that neurotransmission measurements should be included in this initiative. And I hope that by doing this, someday we'll be able to know how something like a thought actually occurs, or how an emotion or a memory is made in the brain. And so I have a dream that in the not too distant future, we will have devices like the one I'm showing you here that will enable scientists, those working in my group, and those working across different research groups. And these devices will enable us to measure all of the neurotransmitters at the same time, and to do so with high chemical resolution, in other words, the ability to tell one species from another, with high temporal resolution, so that we can get information that tells us what's happening at a second-by-second basis, and with high spatial resolution. If we think about that nanoscale architecture of neurons in the brain. And so I've been working now, myself and in collaboration, which is how Paul and I started working together, to develop devices like the ones you see here. And this is the only physics we're going to talk about tonight, or at least on my part. But these devices, interestingly and ironically, are actually based on physics, and they're based on the basic unit of function in the computer. How do you like that? Okay? And that's something called a transistor. All right, in this case, a field effect transistor. And so what we envisioned was that we would be able to build a device, something that looks like what you see here. And we would be able to use these transistors to enable us to detect chemical neurotransmitters fully electronically. And we also envisioned that we would be able to impart some form of chemical selectivity to a transistor. Transistors were problematic for this type of incarnation of a sensing device for a number of reasons. The first is that the transistors in your phone, how many of you have dropped a phone into a bathtub or a toilet or, God, something wet, right? They don't like it, right? They don't like it. They don't like to work in water. More than water, what they really hate is salt. They hate salt water, okay? And so one of the things we had to do in trying to make this vision become a reality was we had to figure out how to make transistors work in salty water, because that's what the extracellular fluid around your neurons, where these chemical neurotransmitters are working, that's what it's made up of. And we were able to solve this problem through a number of advances. Working with nanoscientists, we were able to make the semiconductor material, which you see here in blue, out of a very thin, 4-nanometer thin layer of semiconductor. And this gave us incredible sensitivity. Okay? And so in a field effect transistor, you have two electrodes that you see in gold. You put a current across them. Okay? And the semiconductor gates that current. Right? Now, how do we detect something? We have to put some kind of a receptor on top of it. And in our case, how we got around that salty water problem was that instead of using a protein receptor, which is what other people had proposed and tried to do, we moved to a much smaller type of biomolecule, and that's the nucleic acid. And I'm sure many of you know what nucleic acids are. You've heard of DNA. And the most well-studied function of nucleic acids is to encode information in our cells about how to make proteins. Okay, that's the double-stranded DNA, the double helix. But in fact, nucleic acids also function like proteins. They function in their single-stranded forms. And we can discover very rare sequences called aptamers that are able to fold up and to bind to and to recognize things like serotonin, or norepinephrine, or dopamine, or acetylcholine, all of these chemicals that we're using in our brains. And the wonderful thing about these aptamers is they're small, so they're very close to this semiconductor surface, and they've got a lot of negative charge on their backbones. And so when they curl up, when they change their conformation to bind to a neurotransmitter, that changes the electric field very close to the semiconductor in such a way that it mitigates the effect of these salt ions, something called the Debye length limitation. It sounds like an episode of the Big Bang Theory to me. And in doing this, we were actually able to show that we could sense neurotransmitters down to femtomolar, very, very 10 to the minus 15th molar concentrations. And we could do it in high salt, full strength brain fluid. All right, so we can now start to think about and fabricate devices that look like these. These use micro and nano fabrication. This is a silicon intracerebro recording device. In this case, this is one that's made by a colleague at UCLA. And these have metal electrodes, and they can detect sparks. If we now replace these metal electrodes with field effect transistors and different aptamers for different neurotransmitters, we can now start to think about these multiplexed, high-density, fully electronic recordings. One of the things that Paul and I have worked on for a number of years, and I think he'll talk a little bit more to you about, is the ability to pattern molecules on surfaces. In fact, we discovered a couple of novel methods to do this, and one of them is called chemical liftoff lithography. It's kind of a complicated name. But in fact, it was a very simple concept that utilized the same types of rubber stamps that children use when they play and they make patterns on papers. And we discovered if we did the chemistry just right on these rubber stamps and put them in contact with surfaces, we could pull off and place molecules down to very small scales. And using this kind of lithography, we could form field effect transistor structures like you see here. And these have very small semiconductor gaps, only 300 nanometers. And so this kind of collaboration enabled us now to start to think about very high density recording devices, how we would manufacture them, how would we get around these fundamental problems in science, and hopefully be able to use them now to figure out how information is encoded in chemical signaling. So using the types of devices that I showed you, I'd like to predict that we're going to be able to do three things. I just wanted to see if you were paying attention. All right. I told you, no equations, not a lot of physics. The first is that we know in neuroscience and in psychiatry, where I spend a lot of my time, that we have been unable thus far to be able to understand what happens in brains when people suffer from things like psychiatric disorders, things like depression and anxiety and schizophrenia. We do know, however, that these disorders are not simple chemical imbalances of a single neurotransmitter. And so I hope that by being able to use the devices like I've shown you and others that other people are developing, that we'll be able to start to put this information together in the way that it truly exists in the brain so that we can understand what the fundamental issues are for people suffering from these kinds of disorders. And in by doing so, we may be able to then identify targets for truly new treatments that will hopefully work better for more people. The second thing I hope is that, or I guess that I predict, is that we're going to see a renaissance in small molecule therapeutics. There are many today that have predicted that we are at the end of the kind of drug eras that we have seen over the last 30 or 40 years with new medications being developed. And that we're now heading into what's known as the era of biologics. But in fact, again, using very high-powered microscopy, people have been able to solve the structures of those listening ears, those membrane receptors. And this is an artistic rendering of the structure of one of the serotonin receptors, called the serotonin 2 receptor, binding to a quite famous molecule that I'm sure some people in this audience have heard of, and that's LSD. And people have wondered and studied and investigated for years how LSD works in the brain and why it has such long-lasting actions. And in fact, people are now using micro doses of LSD to treat psychiatric disorders. And part of what we have learned has come from our ability to image at the single atom level how these receptors function and the many nuanced ways in which they bind to the neurotransmitters. And third, what I envision as the fundamental information that will come out of this kind of research is that in addition to the work being done today in genomics, where people can look at all of the gene variants even at the single cell level, transcriptomics, where people can study all of the mRNA transcripts that are produced by a single cell, proteomics, lipidomics, metabolomics, that we will also be able to come to the point where we will know something called a chemical connectome. So we'll be able to put all of the chemical information together in the brain. We'll understand how different systems function together and interact as they do naturally when your brain is functioning. So that we'll be able to decode how information is processed by chemical neurotransmitters and ultimately be able to understand how our brains work. And with that, I'd like to turn the microphone, if you will, over to Paul.
So we decided to do this presentation in the style of William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. So you're going to get two different and overlapping perspectives. We'll let you decide who's the narrator and which one of the brothers is speaking. We can talk about that over wine later. Maybe it's best not to take the analogy too far. As Anne mentioned, I came in from nanoscience and nanotechnology, and I want to tell you first a little bit about those fields. And as you may know, there have been major initiatives around the world. A few years ago, we celebrated a decade of the U.S. National Nanotechnology Initiative, and one of our jobs every day is we're each journal editors. So I founded and run a journal called ACS Nano that hopefully many of you will hear of if you haven't already, trying to represent the field to the world. And we were asked by the White House at the time to describe what we'd done in the first decade of the initiative and what we might do if there were a second decade of funding. That seemed like an important thing to argue and to relate. And what we, as we looked over what we learned in the first decade, we realized that first there was a paradox, and that is, as you'll see, we're able to make atomically precise structures and to understand their properties through the tools that we developed, both in terms of fabricating them and in terms of measuring them. And I helped play a role in some of that work. And I'll show you just a couple of little snippets so you have an idea of, you know, where we came from when we got together. And then the second result, kind of surprising, is that there's very great heterogeneity in the systems that we study, even when they're atomically precise. So if we measure a functional molecule or a functional assembly over and over, we get a different answer. And when I say measure the same one, I don't mean chemically the same one, I mean the very same one. And so that's something that we really need to embrace, particularly in biological systems where conformation, environment play important roles. It turns out if you take an enzyme and just separate it from all others and watch its rate of function, that will vary over time. And we attribute that to changes in conformation and other aspects, and certainly everything that happens in our bodies uses those fluctuations, but also control over function in a number of ways, many of them chemical, as you heard. And so we said, well, we really need to learn how to address this idea of heterogeneity and get down to the individual systems and pick those apart. The second thing that we said we needed to do in the second decade is look to the biotechnology revolution for guidance, where targeted development of tools opened up the ability to address new questions. So, for instance, in the Human Genome Project, it was really only in the last 3 years where there was great progress, when people essentially gave up on the brute force effort to sequence the genome and instead develop the tools that allowed us to compare thousands of species and to pick apart some of the genetic variations that you heard about from Anne. And so as we move the field forward and as we work on initiatives in other fields, we're always technology forward. And so part of the affinity for the Perimeter Institute is really, even though we work at enormously different scales, we're both going into unexplored worlds and developing tools that let us do that and let us try to understand and, in our case, control. That's a little harder to do, you know, in the system studied here. Yeah, the other thing that we realized to our surprise was that because our field developed by bringing people together from chemistry, physics, biology, engineering, medicine, toxicology, and so forth, we'd learn to speak each other's languages, to adopt each other's problems, to adopt each other's approaches and combine those in a way that let us move forward where other fields had not. So you heard a little bit about the entanglement in neuroscience, and I'll pick on neuroscientists for a moment, and then I'll come back to tell you why Anna is particularly special. But you might think that in neuroscience, right, you would invite in people who could understand the biology, the physics, the chemistry, the engineering, the data science, the information, but that inclusiveness has not happened. And so, as you heard about the Brain Initiative, we'll talk about it a little more later, that came from the nanoscience community, not the neuroscience community, and we'll talk a little bit about why and how that happened. And so we feel, as a field, it's incumbent upon us to use that ability to communicate and to train our students and postdocs and junior colleagues and senior colleagues to take on other people's problems where we can contribute and even where we can't contribute. And we'll go on with that. And so one example I like to talk about is we took on chronic pain as a really difficult problem facing the world with opioid crisis and so forth. One of our collaborators was the writer and director of Kung Fu Panda, who had not graduated from high school and yet came up with the best experiments in that project and taught us about communication and perspective and what your brain does when you're playing a video game or watching a movie or cartoon, as the case may be. There's a little bit more we're going to get to, but really the idea is to develop the tools you need to move forward. Now, where I came from is the following. I was trained as a chemist, then a physicist, then electrical engineer, and then later biotechnology when I got sort of okay at the sciences I was doing. And I have helped develop a microscope in the very early days of nanoscience in which we could position individual atoms. And once upon a time, I was the first one to move atoms around. I didn't spell anything. Don Eigler, who I worked with, learned to spell IBM later. I just wanted to find out what was underneath the atoms, so I moved them out of the way. And so that really opened up a world to us because not only could we measure structures, we could build structures. And that won't be a manufacturing technique, but it is a way to make a precise structure and then measure its properties. And this is, you know, along the lines of out so late on a nice evening like this, a joke that Anne and our boys think describes me, but I like to think describes our science. And it goes as follows. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Control freak. Now you say control freak who?
Control freak.
Yeah. There are always two waves with that one. Yeah. Yeah. The other great part of this is that with the microscope, we could look at the chemistry of the surface with atomic resolution. So these are individual atoms, and we're actually imaging two different elements at the same time and looking at the surface the way a molecule or part of a molecule or an atom would. So we're able to put on these chemical goggles and go to town and look at a part of the world around us in a way that we'd never been able to do before. Now, something that's a little special about Anne I should share, and you'll excuse me for, you haven't heard this before, but it came up during the earlier talk. Most people like Anne are actually two people. Right? So there's a there's a measurements person who's like an analytical chemist or electrical engineer, and then there's a neuroscientist, and they sort of talk to each other, right? And one of them, you know, pushes the instrument development, the other one applies it. I would say Anne is the only person in the world who goes soup to nuts.
Oh. You didn't say soup to sparks.
No, yeah. Not psychiatry, I thought. Okay, anyway. All right, let's go on a little bit. So my background is as follows. I developed these microscopes, and I learned to measure beyond structure the functional properties of the assemblies we studied, such as the world's smallest motors. And these are inspired by the biological motors that are moving things around in us that can work with remarkable efficiency, more than 99% conversion of chemical energy to motion. And there's nothing humans make at any scale that can do anything close to that. And our idea was, in a reductionist way, we would pick apart the system and figure out how these things could be so efficient. Now, we didn't want to use the flexible biological systems. Instead, we used rigid ones where we knew where every atom was, and we go from quantum mechanics to mechanical engineering and experiment theory and simulation. So in order to do that, we had to develop two sets of techniques. One was that set of microscopes that could measure structure, function, and other properties all at the same time. many tens and hundreds of thousands of times on the exact same molecular assembly. And the second part that turned out to be interesting and useful in other areas was that we could place the functional system in a controlled environment where we would even design the interactions down to a fraction of atomic spacing to control the stability of the system or its ability to move and other properties. And so, I got into this in large part just because I liked going to these unexplored worlds and looking around, and I'd go where nobody else had been. It kind of sounds familiar, right? And then this really jumped out when Anne and I were colleagues, when she said, would you look at placing neurotransmitters on a surface in such a way to explore the biological interactions and pull down proteins in the brain involved in particular neurotransmitters, and then develop these artificial receptors that you heard about earlier. And that's when we started collaborating 16, 17 years ago.
Okay.
This is that liftoff lithography that Anne mentioned, a technique we developed that can go down to across a whole centimeter, an entire centimeter substrate, we can control down to 10 molecules across. And then with other techniques, we can isolate even individual molecules in place in order to do those studies. Okay, so one of the early lines used on me was the brain's always been nano, right? That my field was just several million years behind. I'll remind you, right? Red blood cells, which you heard about, are a few microns across. DNA is a couple nanometers across, and we learned to control even down here, okay? And all at the same time, and out to much larger scales over to the blue light that I think doesn't show up on camera. Or maybe it's behind a pole there, so you can't see it either. Yeah, in any case, there was this this coincidence, and only a coincidence, that the scale of semiconductor technologies had reached the synapse scale that you heard about earlier. And that was the basis when I was asked to put together a group of nanoscientists for the White House to propose grand challenges that we might promote to the public to say what the field had done, to justify our continued existence. Sounded important again. The computer scientists had done a great job with that. They didn't generate a lot of publicity, but they generated some programs that really let them move their field forward. And so we were asked to do that in nanoscience. The neuroscientists were also given that opportunity, but could never agree on anything, it turned out, and were dismissed. And as Anne told you, our group was largely made up of physicists and engineers. The one thing we proposed was to study the brain and to try to figure out how a neural circuit worked so that we could measure every neuron in it, we could stimulate it, and be able to predict the output. Right? And then we proceeded to get in a fight. It lasted for a couple of years, where, as you heard, the Sparks said, measure voltages, the brain's a computer, and you're done. And you already know it's not. And so we fought back, and much of this published in the literature. And eventually we had a meeting the December before the White House announcement, in which we had the heads of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the science arm of the White House, the leader of the DARPA biology program, and most particularly the directors of the National Institute of Mental Health, who'd shared a lab with Anne back during her training, and the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. And their comment was, unless you measure the chemistry, we're not interested, because most of the diseases they cared about in their institute involve the chemical neurotransmission in the brain and malfunctions of it. And if you wanted to understand those small differences that led to the disease, and even from a basic science point of view, if you wanted to know what that critical small difference was and how it affected function in disease or animal models of disease, you had to measure the chemistry. And they basically everybody turned to Anne and said, you'll be happy when she speaks. And that was true. So that all got approved. President Obama announced the initiative in April. We published the technology roadmap for it in our journal about 2 weeks before. Turns out you're not allowed to tell the government how to spend their money. you can propose what might be interesting. So the timing was very important. We had a rush to do that, and we brought people in from neuroscience, from chemistry, from physics, from engineering, and so forth, together to write that proposal, and then we got the go-ahead. Now, after that, and you heard a lot about, you know, the brain already, after that, there was another initiative you might not have heard of called the Precision Medicine Initiative. And a bunch of people in the field put that forward. They got the approval of the White House, but it didn't get much attention. And there was an analysis at OSTP, the Science Technology Policy Office in the White House, about why that was. And they decided that the difference was no nanoscientists. That we had been able to draw people together from other fields to say, what problems do you have? What approaches could we take? What do we know and what don't we know? And so the third and final initiative was the U.S. Microbiome Initiative, which has also been reproduced around the world, and they asked us to lead the technology roadmap for that again. Arguably, right, that's even less nano than, you know, measurements of neural circuits in the brain, where you want to be able to measure the ocean, the atmosphere, right, your skin. We have about a kilogram of bugs that live usually happily with us, sometimes turn on us and try and kill us, right? And we want to understand the signaling molecules using some of the technologies that Anna's developed for the brain and listen in and see how they're talking to each other and what they're saying and what that means for our health and other properties. And again, you know, we wrote the roadmap for that and were invited back to the White House for the announcement. Okay. So this is actually the first time we've talked about this publicly, but we're trying to make this more of a routine, and it's something that we hope the Perimeter Institute will also join us in doing. And so we brought together curious people from many fields. It's somewhat more straightforward at UCLA, where around one courtyard we have all of science, engineering, and medicine. It's a very dense campus. It's the largest of the UC campuses by population, but the smallest by area, so we see each other a lot. We have a nano center with about 150 faculty from 30 different departments and 1,000 students and postdocs and 2,000 users from around the world. And so the idea is to lay out problems for a growing group of curious people interested in taking on the ones that they can and working together to do that. So as senior faculty, we're often on advisory boards, and we learn general solutions to solve problems. But there's no reason not to start earlier. And so some of our students in my group, for instance, have people from chemistry, physics, math, neuroscience, bioengineering, electrical engineering, pediatrics, oncology, and so forth. We have all the MDs and MD PhDs come in and say, you know, I saw a patient with this. We don't have anything for it. You know, here's an idea, or can someone think of an idea? And I'll give you an example of that. And so we've expanded that with open meetings, and now we want to institutionalize that by bringing together more and more faculty, staff, students, postdocs, investors, IP attorneys, and so forth, and identify problems upstream, identify possible solutions, and then, in our experience, the people who are interested stay at the table, and the ones who say, I don't have anything to contribute here, I'll be back next time, pull away. And rather than have people embedded in the field, we get the knowledge of the experts who lay out the refractory or at least unsolved problems, and then we try and develop new approaches. So it turns out to be quite fun. As I said, we're trying to grow these teams and start even, we have a first-year graduate student who has three such projects in different fields already in his first few months in grad school, just by being exposed to these opportunities and being able to, you know, take them on creatively. I told you about chronic pain. A fairly simple one is in periodontal disease. So it turns out half of adults in America will get periodontal disease. We have a terrific dental school. If you do get such a surgery, you'll get a membrane put in to protect where the surgery took place, and it's either made of Teflon, which does nothing and other than a barrier, and has to be removed with a second surgery, or it's collagen and it just degrades essentially uncontrollably. And so our periodontal and prosthodontist colleagues, three clinicians, came and said, we should be able to do something better. And so we developed a simple membrane out of biocompatible and approved components that where we can control the degradation rate, so no second surgery. It's antibacterial on the outside and osteogenic. It helps the bone grow back on the other side. And we can print about 20,000 of those in a day with one machine. So, and that was just sitting around saying, we need something better than what we have in the office every day. So they're not always refractory grand challenges, but sometimes, you know, a simple targeted solution and, you know, some work in the lab goes a long way. And so one of the key things is, how do you seed those ideas and get them going, right? And how do you bring the people in who are interested? And that second part does not seem to be a problem, right? There are plenty of curious people, particularly in academics, and it's fun, right? If you just like hearing about problems, even from a spectator point of view, it's fun. But if you can actually go in there and do something, then it's particularly exciting. And so I'll point out one recent one in our group. So we had a clinical fellow, a postdoc, who joined our pediatrics faculty a few months ago, and he pointed out that in order to do the bone marrow transplants that he does on kids with leukemia and would like to do for other diseases, immune diseases, diseases where hemoglobin's miscoded, like a sickle cell, where there are 300,000 patients a year, or thalassemias, which afflict mostly South Asian, Southeast Asian people, another 300,000 cases a year. You can't replace their stem cells now in a safe and efficient way. It's just not worth using the viruses that are typically used to transfect the stem cells because you risk giving them an off-target cancer through what's called insertional mutagenesis. It's very costly, several hundred thousand dollars per patient. So if you multiply that by the number of patients, it doesn't work out. And so he posed a challenge to the group to say, come up with a way to do this efficiently and safely, and ideally in an hour while a patient is in the office. And so over a few months, we came up with six different ways to do that, all of them with everything compatible that we're now testing on actual hematopoietic stem cells from patients, not into patients at all yet, but we've already reached that milestone of being able to do the billion cells an hour that we would need to do rather than a month at a virus facility, and those three in the U.S. are booked up through 2020 already. And so we have this opportunity, and we've grabbed people who are the clinicians. We have several people who do bone marrow transplants every day as part of their work, bioengineers at Harvard, got on the National Academy yesterday, Joanne Eisenberg, who makes an artificial mucus that we can use to coat the channels, her startup company, collaborators at Singapore, Duke, and of course, Anne. So with that, I'd like to bring the brain back up. And we would be happy and delighted to follow up with a discussion here online and afterwards during the reception. And once again, thank you to the Perimeter Institute for having us. We spent a couple of years scheduling the chance to come here. We were originally going to come on the 150th anniversary of Canada's independence and couldn't quite work out those dates. So we're happy to get here if belatedly. It's been a fantastic visit and hopefully many more interactions to come. Thank you.
So let's, the microphone's there. Good. You can start, and I'll take a look at the online question.
I'm wondering if your research has gone into the area of concussions. Brain issues associated with concussions is a big thing, not only in professional sports, but for people who accidentally fall on ice and hit their head. As you know, one of the side effects of amnesia is amnesia in concussions, and I wondered if you had any involvement in that kind of research.
That's a wonderful question. We haven't started working in that specific field, but what we do envision, and one of the reasons is because even with concussion, the skull is still intact. So the types of things that we develop, we won't be able to use in people unless we already have some license to go into the brain. However, in a related problem, and that's the problem of traumatic brain injury, we are starting to see some of the technologies that we use in my laboratory in patients. And these are in cases where we already have some reason to open the skull and go into the brain. So, for instance, a method called microdialysis, which we currently use in experimental animals, it's also being used in traumatic brain injury patients. But I think for concussive illness, we'll have to, unfortunately, be relegated to methods that operate outside the head and right now don't have the kind of resolution that the techniques that we use do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'll jump to an online question. When are we going to be able to make nanobots to repair mutations in cells that are causing aging? We need to hurry up. I don't want to be 70 forever.
So I think the quick answer to that question is you need to invite George Church here to give a lecture who works on nanobots.
But. Yeah. So it's very limited what we can do now with molecular motors, for instance. We can drive, they're not really robots, we can drive objects around, but at very small scales because the dimensions are already small. So how you get them to a particular place with aging, presumably you'd have to do every cell that you care about, also a problem. And so that that's still much more science fiction than what you know we might see in a movie or a novel. But I think Anna's right that there are biological mechanisms and there are biological functions that may be able to be co-opted to do what biology does. We have that happy coincidence of nanoscale being the scale of function in biology, and there are many biological machines that might be able to do something like what the tweeter is asking.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In the theater.
Are there any thoughts that some of the actions of your neurotransmitters might be possibly due, a la the way your nose detects smells, to the primary vibrational frequencies of the neurotransmitters?
I'm probably not.
Okay, I think I can take that one. So there was a claim that was true, but in fact, you can shift the vibrational frequencies by swapping out, for instance, hydrogen to deuterium. And so that hypothesis was debunked. It got a lot of attention. There was a popular book by the leading proponent, but I would say the people who did the best work in that area were able to isolate the receptors and then change the neurotransmitters in a way that would change the vibrational frequencies, and they still function properly. So that vibrational hypothesis, I think, has been very strongly debunked.
Is it true then that there were receptors for all of your transmitters, neurotransmitters? Different receptors?
There are multiple different receptors. There are multiple receptors for each neurotransmitter. So for instance, for serotonin, where I spend most of my time doing investigations, we have already identified 14 different receptors for serotonin. And of those 14, some of the messages can be alternately spliced, giving rise to additional heterogeneity, which Paul talked about. There is one ligand-gated ion channel, serotonin receptor, and it's made up of subunits, and the subunits can be alternately arranged. So there seems to be these multiple layers of complexity and heterogeneity in the receptors themselves beyond this sheer number of chemical neurotransmitters. Okay. And there are probably levels of heterogeneity that we have yet to discover. They're likely.
As well as promiscuity. There's some crossover from one neurotransmitter system to another. They're not 100 orthogonal communication channels, if I understand correctly.
No, and they're interacting all the time. We've been interested recently in studying just two neurotransmitter systems at the same time. We talk about wanting to do all of them, but realistically, we can do something in my laboratory that most people can't do, and that's just look at two. And what we've found is that every time we look at two instead of one, the hypothesis that we go into the experiment with is wrong. We were talking about hypotheses today and how important they are. And that's, you know, one of the mantras in my laboratory is to keep your eyes and your mind wide open. And so all of the things that we try to predict or we begin an investigation with a hypothesis, these are just starting points. They're just ideas. We're really trying to look at some, you know, black box, and we're often incorrect. But through high-powered measurement tools, we're able to collect data then that can tell us where we're wrong, and that helps us to shape our next hypothesis.
Yeah, part of the fun of going in unexplored areas is you have a new way to measure something, and what you look for is the opportunity to say, that's odd.
Yeah.
That's when the fun starts.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
We never say to our students, that's wrong.
Yeah. Data's data.
Yeah. My question concerns quantitative electroencephalography. The big rage right now. Has that contributed anything at all to the BRAIN initiative?
It's not part of the BRAIN initiative. However, it's interesting you bring that up because I do have a collaboration with someone who's doing quantitative EEG. And we were combining those types of measurements with some of the measurement tools that we use to look at the function of the serotonin system through some peripheral markers in the blood. So QEEG, again, all of these methods where we have to stay outside of the head, at least for now, they give us broad brush strokes, which we need. And they're starting to help us understand maybe which large brain region might be working with another brain region, for instance, when a person is under, you know, doing an activity. And so I think where we'll gain some traction is when we can combine these kinds of things, which we can do in people. You know, all of you, we don't, you know, need any special license to drill a hole in your head. and then combine that with the kinds of studies we can do in patients or in experimental animals where we can get high resolution and then kind of come to an intersection. Yeah, but those are fascinating methods.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's take the last question here inside.
Since we are at Perimeter Institute, I have to ask a quantum question. Are you aware of any scientific research regarding evidence of quantum phenomena in the brain? For example, I was reading that conscience could have like a quantum root. Also, if at nanotechnology research there are other evidence of quantum phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe we'll both take a little stab
sure.
at that.
Sure, you do the brain, I'll do nano.
Yeah. Again, we do have a colleague at UCLA, Jim Shimshevsky, who delves into this a little bit, and there are other people who are looking at this. I'm not sure that we're at the level yet where I would say we can come to an intersection that would give us a satisfying answer. Again, something we were discussing earlier today, in physics, we can measure things. We know about the individual units of a system with pretty deep knowledge. In fact, the knowledge is so deep that we can have an institute like this where 300 people can use equations and mathematics to try to predict what happens. But I think when you try to make a leap and thinking about quantum phenomena and something like the brain, you've got just a really large, wide open space that I would say we're not ready to bridge, because in biological systems, the complexity is such that we're not at a point where we can describe the function of these systems at the level of detail with which that we would be able to predict something like a quantum phenomenon. I hope we'll get there. Nothing in biology violates any of the laws of the universe that we're aware of, so it should be possible, but I think it's going to take us, you know, a lot longer.
Right, and at the nanoscale, many, many quantum phenomena are observed, many for the first time or only at those scales. Our entire microscope is based on quantum mechanics and the extent of the electrons away from the atoms of this needle that we use, overlapping with the electrons of the substrate that we're measuring.
Right, but does that have anything to do with consciousness.
I think I heard consciousness and nano rather.
Oh, I see.
Thank you, counselor.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ann Andrews and Dr. Paul Reese.